Right, so should we start off with an intro?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I've got a couple of things to say before we do that.
Oh, okay. Go on then.
I wanted to say thank you to the people who have asked for the tree story.
Oh, yes, because there have been a lot.
There's so many.
Yeah.
Steve Henderson, Kate McGovern, Lee Grant, Phil Sticks, Gary Clark, Emerald's Emporium of Curiosities, Mark at HBoardK, Martin Healy is 8. Oh, and Paul Wainwright, but he doesn't really count.
Come on, that's close.
Because he's, strictly speaking, his family.
And Tom.
Well, don't speak to me on that one, Jeff.
Well, all right then, I'm me.
just need one more, that's it. But I just wanted to thank those guys for their support. It means
so you're saying, John, if one more person asks you to read your tree story, you will read it?
Yeah, they were my arbitrary rules, weren't they, in the first place? The
right,
nine
that's,
people.
There you go, you heard it here, folks. One request.
Yeah, just the one.
Even if you don't know what we're talking about, just send us an email saying...
Tree story.
Yeah, tree story, I'm in.
Yes,
me,
trees.
Please. Yes, trees. Yeah, just chuck us a thumbs up emoji or something like that, and that'll do.
Excellent.
So yeah.
Oh yes, and speaking of audience engagement as well, I don't know if you saw on Twitter there was a question from a fellow member of the online writing community, Elizabeth Eckstein, Twitter handle at @redelixir, and she just happened to ask, "What's with the hate of exclamation points?"
Oh.
Presumably she means exclamation marks, but I think that's what they call them in the States, isn't it? And at first, I answered with a typically glib response.
It was quite glib.
Exclamation marks. And then I thought, what is the beef with the exclamation marks? Why do they have such a bad rep?
I really don't know.
No, I didn't know either. So I thought, I'll do a bit of research. Would you like a very quick rundown of the exclamation mark?
Yes, please, John. That sounds fascinating.
Yes!
Thanks, Betty.
He exclaimed.
Thanks for your enthusiasm, man. So, very quickly, one theory of its origin... the most likely one is that it was derived from the Latin exclamation of joy, which is oi, an O and an I. And in the Middle Ages, copyists used to write at the end of a sentence to indicate joy. And over time, the I got moved on top of the O, and eventually the O sort of shrank to become the dot, and it became the little exclamation mark.
Oi.
That's it. So you can now at the end of a sentence, if you want to exclaim something, you just say oi instead. Won't confuse anybody.
Wow. All those times I've said, oi, mate, and I've actually been speaking Latin, and I never knew.
But kind of backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has slang names too. Secretaries in the 50s called them bangs, presumably because of comic books at the time. An exclamation mark and a speech bubble kind of denoted a loud noise. In hacker culture, it's called a bang, a shriek, or a pling, in case you ever want to...
Pling?
Pling, yeah, apparently.
Wow.
And in the printing world, it can be called a screamer, a gasper, a slammer, or a startler, for obvious reasons, I guess. And it says in Wikipedia that overly frequent use of the exclamation mark is generally considered poor writing, for it distracts the reader and devalues the mark's significance.
I mean, apparently. Come on. That's all nonsense, isn't it? Stuff like that.
It's made up. It's just made up. Yeah. And I think the real death knell for the exclamation mark seems to have come after F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "Cut out all these exclamation points. An exclamation point is like laughing at your own joke." And after that, I think people just stopped using it. They're kind of regarded as very casual,
more
formal. So you can imagine if you're a serious writer, that is that's a major no-no, isn't it? So there you go, a little history of the exclamation point Elizabeth.
But if your character speaks in a very exclaimed manner, what's so wrong with putting an exclamation mark to show that they're going?
That's it, because
they
exactly.
are. Yeah, exactly.
What's wrong
it's
with
the
that?
Same with all. There's all these stupid writing rules that someone's thought of or has taken as absolute literal gospel because one writer said it once, and then they go, no. Shouldn't use capital A's in your work. What?
Yeah, it's not like, I don't think there are, sort of literary agents. Maybe I'm wrong. Get in touch if you are a literary agent. If you read a manuscript and it's got more than 3 exclamation marks in it, that you go, no, not having that, even if it's really good.
Yeah, because surely the point is that it just makes it easier for the reader to read. And if it makes it easier.
Unless they're badly used, in which case, fine. But this idea of just don't use them, that's the trouble. People take this thing as just don't use them. It's like, well, you can if you use them well.
People take words far too literally, don't they? That's the problem.
Yeah. Adverbs as well. Adverbs are a massive one, aren't they?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, I suppose if you overuse anything, then it can get annoying, I guess, if you're reading it and you notice something. And then once you've noticed it, that's it, isn't it? You go, oh, God, they're doing that again. And they're doing it again.
Use sparingly.
Use sparingly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Use it in moderation.
Just use them well.
Exactly, Tommy.
Just, yeah.
Just do it properly. Write properly.
Just write proper.
So there you go.
I think that ticks the education box for today, doesn't it?
Yeah. Shall we move on and tick the interesting box then?
Yeah, okay.
There you go.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, Tom.
Well, I wasn't thinking about us. I was thinking about Kaz, who was actually
really
interesting.
Oh, yeah. All right. Fair enough. Yeah,
I was kind of passing that one down the line, so we wouldn't have to be responsible for that.
Yeah. So if you're sick of us talking about exclamation points, fortunately, we've got someone else coming to talk today, haven't we, lads?
We have indeed. We've got CJ Flippin' Tudor. That's not actually her name. She doesn't use the flipping.
It's just an exclamation mark, isn't it?
That was just an exclamation mark, exactly.
Yeah, she's coming in to talk about her books and her previous jobs before she was a mega best-selling author. And, having stuff optioned for TV and all sorts of exciting things.
Her career has just exploded, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has.
I think it's fair to say that she is a big name.
But, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? And she can even, I think she's done the best at, it's like identifying the moment where things took off, which is a particular quote from a particular author. So, yeah, stick around to hear that.
Enjoy.
Yes, really enjoy it!
Exclamation mark. So I think we should start by saying that we have the wonderful CJ Tudor on the line with us today. And we could probably start by saying that at some point, the three of us have probably all voiced one of your scripts in the past.
That's
kind of
how we
all come together.
Yeah, I mean, we've all sort of...
So, because you were a copywriter, weren't you?
I was. We've all passed kind of ships in the night, haven't we, at various radio stations and things, I guess, probably over the years, never working in the same place at the same time. But maybe, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably, and probably cursed me because it was probably dreadful. It's so weird. It's like, it seems like sort of a long time ago, but it's not really, since I was sort of writing radio ads and things, because I did it, even when I wasn't working at radio stations, I was doing it freelance for years afterwards as well. You know, got to earn a crust.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely remember seeing your name on scripts and thinking,
I'm sorry.
It's got the ring of a bestseller all about it.
Where did you work, Kaz?
Oh, my God, all over. I was at Radio Trent when it was Radio Trent many years ago. And I was at Nottingham a couple of times, Century, up at Hallam. I worked at most radio stations across the country at one stage or another in a freelance capacity or sort of employed.
Yeah.
I was in radio for a long time. I mean, I worked at Radio Trent when I started there when I was 17. So a long time.
5 long years ago.
Just a few years ago, really, honestly.
Yeah, because in the blurb on your books, it says that you have been a trainee reporter, radio scriptwriter, dog walker, voiceover artist, television presenter, copywriter. So you've done a fair few things, but is all through those, have you always had a sort of burning desire to be an author? Has that always been the dream?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I always wanted to write. And you know, I didn't really sort of keep it up in my 20s and things. I think I had other stuff going on and, you know, as you do sort of at that age. But I always used to sort of write in the background. But I think I came from a background where, like, you know, you being an author wasn't really a proper job. So much as that's what I dreamed of doing, it was a case of, well, you love writing, but you've got to find a more practical way of using it to make a living, really. Hence, you know, I got a job at the local newspaper, then ended up in radio doing the, you know, radio ads, worked in an advertising agency for a while. So I think, you know, it was never really seen as a career path. But I think it wasn't until I got to my early 30s that I thought, you know what, I still got this kind of itch to do this. And if I don't kind of try and make an effort to write something and finish it, at least now, you know, I'm never going to do it. So I didn't really knuckle down to try and even finishing a book until I was sort of in my early sort of to mid 30s.
There's that bloody word again, effort.
Yeah.
Always comes up, isn't it?
Effort, no, yep.
It is, doesn't it?
It is quite a big part of actually writing something, isn't it? Having to put the effort in.
Well, and time as well, isn't it? Because like you said, we all have to have jobs that pay the bills. So you're kind of fitting it around work and family and kids and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, time, I think, is the biggest thing.
Yeah. Did you actually actively stop doing voiceovers in order for that like mental shift to take place? Did you decide, okay, I'm going to start being a writer for real now? Or
no, because, you know, you can't afford to, can you?
Yeah.
Unless you've got a very rich partner who can support you. But, I mean, to be fair, the voiceover stuff kind of faded off a bit because, you know, there was a time when it was quite easy to just, you know, be a chancer and do voiceovers and get paid quite well for it. And then lots of people caught on to this. So lots of people who were much better than me came into the industry and stole all the work. And so, hence, that was why I was... Damn those talented people. So I was still doing script writing. But I also set up a dog walking business. And I sort of did that when my little girl was quite young because I was like, well, we need to find some other way to get money in. The freelance script writing isn't quite covering my half of the mortgage and stuff. So I'd worked as a dog walker for someone else I knew before. So it just seemed a good option to do that. So I had to do the writing around all of that, you know, chasing dogs across muddy fields and looking after Betty, who was about two at the time, and all of that. Yeah, I just had to sort of fit it in around everything else. I'd have loved to have gone, but that's it, darling. I'm going to concentrate on being a writer now. Imagine Neil's face. You're what?
It is. That's an awkward conversation to have, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some people are lucky enough to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But for most of us, you know, you've got to just crack on and sort of squeeze out those small bits of time to write. You know, that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Does dog walking lend itself to that?
It is, actually. It's quite good for plotting.
You know, isn't it an inspiring job?
Well, yeah, because, you know, you're spending a lot of time just walking around with dogs. Yeah. It's perfect for sort of, you know, thinking of ways to kill people and stuff. I thoroughly recommend it. But if I'm ever stuck on a plot point now, I take the dog for a walk. You know, lots of time to unknot plot twists and all those sort of things. So I used to do a lot of, you know, well, fantasizing about being a published author as well, obviously.
That's almost a full-time job, isn't it?
We do a lot of fantasizing, yeah. Who did you used to fantasize about being interviewed by?
Yeah, who was your talk show fantasy for your
You guys, obviously, obviously. But, you know, I think you all have those dreams of like, oh, my goodness, you know, my book's published and I've got my quote from Stephen King on the cover or my book being made into a film or whatever. And you know, those lovely things that you imagine when you're a wannabe writer sometimes.
You mentioned Stephen King, Kaz, and I do remember a few years ago when The Chalk Man had been out for a period. And I remember seeing that tweet from Stephen King and... He was basically saying, what, like, hey, you should read this, it's good. It's a bit like a British female version of me, I think is what he said, something like that. Can you
Stephen King, yeah.
Talk us through, give us a snapshot of that moment in the Tudor household.
Oh, my God. Well, I was actually, I mean, he is a huge hero of mine. I mean, The Chalk Man was basically my sort of love letter to Stephen King. And, of course, all the stuff that I loved growing up as a teenager in the 80s. All those sort of films with kids getting into dark adventures, Stephen King, James Herbert, all of that. So it was a massive homage in a way to Mr. King. And there were lots of nods to his books and characters in it. So I was on the train into London for some meeting or do or something or other. And I'd opened up Twitter. I was opening up my laptop to do some work, but then of course that involved me opening up Twitter, obviously. And it was the first tweet at the top of the page. It was like, and I follow Stephen King, obviously, and he tweets about books quite often. So I started to read it thinking, oh, I wonder what book he's talking about. And then went, oh my God.
This book sounds familiar. Book.
Wow.
I think I may have leapt up and done a bit of a bloody hell in the middle of the train. And then the next thing I did was check it wasn't a fake account, obviously. You know, because I couldn't quite believe it. And then I phoned Neil and hyperventilated on the phone to Neil about it. And yeah, it, and I just had all these other tweets in response to it. So it was bonkers. I say it's the best day of my life, and then I have to say, apart from meeting Neil and having my little girl, it was so amazing because he is such a big hero of mine. It was the most incredible thing, and then I sort of replied in a very, you know, sort of British sort of, oh my crumbs, you know, you're my hero type of thing. And I love you. But then he very graciously just responded and wrote, "You rock," which was even better than first week, quite frankly, and is going on my headstone. Yeah, it was a massive, massive thing for me. It meant such a lot. And so weird to just try and imagine Stephen King, as I imagine him sat in front of some roaring fireplace with, I don't know, a great big chair with skulls on it and things, reading my book.
Simultaneously tapping on 100 typewriters as he goes.
Basically, his next few novels out.
Yeah. Wow. So did you think at that moment, was that like the, this is it, I've done it, this is the sort of big... Right, that's it now. I've made it.
I'm at the top of the mountain. It's all downhill from here. That's it. I've peaked.
Well, yeah, that is kind of your thought, isn't it? It is sort of like, have I peaked now? This is it. So someone actually said that too. They said, you know, I think they were trying to joke on a Twitter thing. Oh, maybe you've peaked too early. It was a bit like, well, do you know what? I can live with that.
It's not a bad peak.
Because I've got my moment right here. Yeah, basically, that's it forever. Now that's fine. I'm done.
It's hell of
all
a moment,
good.
That, Kaz, to be fair. Yeah. But we don't just want to hear about success on this podcast, because it is the Failing Writers podcast.
That's dull, isn't it?
We'd love to hear about sort of the process of, I mean, did you go through a lot of rejections? What was it like when you were kind of pitching your book out? How did it all happen?
Oh, God. I mean, well, I started seriously trying to sort of finish a book and then get published in sort of my early 30s. And, you know, I finally got published with a chalk man. Right. That's 46. So that's how long it took from really... You know, I've got to try and, you know, knuckle down, try and write a book, try and do what I've always wanted to do, to actually getting the book published. So it was over a decade of trying and being rejected. Not with that particular book. You know, I wrote other stuff, probably, you know, 3 or 4 manuscripts actually.
And in the same kind of genre?
It was in a similar kind of genre. And I did actually have an agent. I was about 35, 36. I submitted a manuscript, and I got taken on by an agent, which was like, this is it, I've made it, I'm going to get published, it's all going to be wonderful and brilliant. And then we sort of went through the editing process, because there's always an editing process with books, with agents, with, you know, with editors or publishers, there are always more edits. And it very quickly sort of became apparent that they wanted to kind of change what I wrote, if that makes sense. They represented a lot of very high profile, very successful, you know, they're a good agent, crime writers who wrote, I would say, more sort of procedural crime or straight psychological crime. And I kept trying to go a bit Stephen King on them, basically, and they kept trying to take that out of the writing, and I kept trying to put it back in. And the first book I submitted that, you know, I thought was the one I was going to, you know, see published never went anywhere. And then I wrote another book with them, and then again the same sort of thing happened, and I went, do you know what, I'm absolutely bloody miserable, I'm not enjoying this anymore.
If only you had some kind of Twitter time machine that you could have gone and got your Stephen King tweet. And
it would have all been good.
And shown them that at the time. And gone, look, hold on a minute.
You see, you're wrong.
You're editing.
But I think they were probably right at the time. I remember them saying to me at one point, basically, you know, this stuff you want to write, you know, it's not publishable. It is not publishable. There's not a single publisher who would take this on. And they may well have been right at that point in time. All I knew was that...
How does that feel, though, to hear that?
Frustrating, I think, was the thing. And I was unhappy. And I guess, also, I'm pretty bloody-minded as well. So probably part of me thought, well, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong. And I think it is good. And I think somebody will want to publish it. And they did. It just took quite a few years later. But I left them. I realised that I was having no fun. I wasn't writing what I wanted to write. I wasn't getting even a sniff of a publisher. It wasn't really working out for anybody. So I decided that I would leave them. And it was all mutual and amicable and everything. And then I thought, as soon as I'd done it, I thought I'd made the biggest mistake I could possibly make. So I've just left this really successful agency and thrown myself back into the slush pile. And it was I was maybe 37, 38 then. It was obviously another sort of 5 or 6 years before I wrote The Chalk Man and submitted it to the agent I have now, Madeline Milburn. And I had a totally different experience with that book and with Madeline actually as well. I think thinking back, the agent I was with wasn't a particularly good fit for me in more ways than just the subject matter. But you don't know that because an agent offers you representation and you're like, oh God, you leap at it, you know, like you think you're made. And I sort of learned perhaps a good lesson there. But, you know, I threw myself back in the slush pile and I kept writing and hopefully I got better. I sort of wrote short stories, got a few of those published in a few sort of women's magazines and stuff. And every little bit where I got a short story published or, you know, just before the Chalk Man, I won a couple of sort of competitions, and it just makes you feel like you're not completely wasting your time with the writing. Mm. But yeah, there was a point, I think, probably not long before I wrote the Chalk Man, where I'd had Betty and I'd got the dog walking business, and, you know, time was incredibly short to fit in the writing. And I did think perhaps, you know, that was it. I'd kind of had my moment and it was gone. And it might not happen again. And you know, it wasn't that bad because I was happy. I liked my dog walking business. I was, you know, I had my little girl. It wasn't the end of the world. And perhaps that was good thinking. I kind of relaxed into it and I wrote the Chalk Man with really no expectations.
Yeah, I guess there's something to be said for that, isn't it? About, you know, once you let go of ridiculous expectations and just do something for the enjoyment of it, then you're going to bring your best stuff is going to come to the fore, I suppose.
I think it's true. I don't think you can write with a vision to getting published. You just can't.
Yeah.
For a start, because what is popular right now in publishing, by the time you get published, by the time that book will come out, will be 2 years down the line, and that moment will have gone.
Yeah.
Publishers are already looking for something other than what is being published right now, so you'll always be behind the curve. So you can only really, without saying too wanky about it, be true to yourself, you know, and write from your heart, write what you love, because that might then be the thing in a couple of years' time that publishers are really hungry for. And that's kind of how it was with the Chalk Man.
It sounds like you. Yeah. It sounds like you enjoy the writing process. Are there ever times where you're just staring at a screen and not enjoying it?
Well, there's always those times, because I've realised now there's a part in every book, normally around 200 pages, where you get to that hump. And you go, oh my God, this is all awful. I can't make this work. I'm never going to make this come together. It's the worst thing I've ever written. What was I thinking of? I hate it. And then you kind of plough on because you have to. And then you get over that hump, generally, not all the time. And you finish the book and you somehow make it work.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's always that stage in every book, I think, where you doubt yourself, you doubt the writing, you doubt the story, you doubt everything. It's all wrong. And you have to sort of push through that. And quite often there's a temptation. I've said this to a number of sort of other writers and people who've asked about writing process. There's quite often the temptation of the shiny new idea. Mm. So I quite often find that I've got another idea for a book halfway through the book I'm writing. And of course, that idea is exciting and it's new because I haven't screwed it up yet. And that next idea will be the book that is perfect and wonderful. And I won't have any difficulty writing it and it'll be amazing. And my editor won't want to make any changes to it. So there's always a shiny new idea, and it's also tempting to think that one will be perfect. But actually, every book has tough bits that you have to kind of push on through to get to the end.
So are you a pantster like Stephen King, or are you a strict outliner?
Oh, God, I'm definitely a pantster. I was speaking to, I did a podcast with another author, actually, who I know the other day, and he's the exact opposite. And you know, you can't change. It fills you with horror. Like his process of planning out chapters and detailed plans and knowing the ending and writing like 20,000 words of a plan before he starts the book is my idea of an absolute and complete nightmare.
Because
I'm like, what's the point of writing the book at that stage? You know, I'd be so
exhausted
to tears. Yeah, 20,000 words of a plan?
And I feel that takes a bit of the fizz out of it as well, doesn't it? For me.
I think it does. Like, I think it takes the spontaneity.
Yeah.
Whereas I like to just dive in and see where it goes, really. Which means there's a lot of work in the edits. You know, I go back doing a lot of tweaking and changing things. Because I've had a great idea to do something partway through, but that means I've got to go and, you know, rewrite bits at the beginning to make it fit in. But I find it just keeps it fresh and it keeps it more interesting for me generally. But yeah, a little bit of planning can't hurt. Knowing roughly how it's going to end is quite a good thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I often change the endings. I often think I know how it's going to end. Then I'll get 3/4 of the way through and go, oh, I could do this instead. That's much more fun. Let's do that. And then I had to go rewrite huge chunks of it again.
I think that kind of comes through, because in reading your book, sometimes I'm sitting there thinking, right, it shouldn't be that hard to work out the ending. I should be able to figure this out. And then I get there and I'm like, no, didn't see that coming.
Excellent.
But then thinking maybe that you didn't have a clue how it was going to end as you were writing
it. That's
basically it. I don't
feel
so bad.
That's probably that point where I go, yeah, it could go that way, but let's do this. Let's do this instead. That'll throw them. And I think that's quite good if you're writing thrillers or mysteries, because if you're sort of only just thinking of it, then you're hopefully misleading the reader as well.
Yes, but doing it in an honest way,
very misleading.
Not in that awful way when you know when stuff is deliberately misleading and withhold stuff, and you get that awful feeling as a reader of you've cheated me out of not guessing this, rather than
there's nothing worse.
Awful.
I mean, I think every thriller or mystery you should, as a reader, be able to feasibly guess the ending. The breadcrumbs should be there. It shouldn't be one of those endings where it's like, you know, how could I ever have guessed that? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You shouldn't ever sort of have that feeling. You should be able to work it out, even if you don't quite work it out in time. Or be able to go back and go, oh, yeah, you see, now I know that bit makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
You should always have those breadcrumbs.
Oh, there were triplets, but no one ever mentioned anything about
yeah,
that.
Exactly. There was a twin. Oh, yeah. All those horrible cliches that, you know, I have read, you know, thrillers where, you know, you do get that type of ending. And you're right, you feel cheated because it's frustrating. Mm. It's worse than actually just it being too obvious. If it's so not obvious that you couldn't possibly guess it, it's just a cheat, I think, basically.
Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because reading your stuff, it seems as if they are meticulously planned out, particularly with sort of the Chalk Man, where you're jumping back from something that happened now to something that happened 20 or 30 years ago. There's a really sort of, it seems like a well-thought-out thread that ties you from one chapter to the next, to the next, to the next, that keeps you kind of going. But you're saying you're just making it up as you go along.
Yeah, basically. You know, I'm always quite surprised when I actually, you know, get a book together and it kind of works like that. But like a lot of them, like the Chalk Man, it's a lot of work in the edits. The Chalk Man I wrote in two separate sections, so I wrote all the kids' stuff first. And then I wrote all the adult stuff. And then I linked all the chapters. So there was a lot of tweaking when it came to putting the two bits together, basically.
Yes.
But it just worked to write it like that. And then you go back and you do sort of the hard work bit of actually editing it and making sure it does all tie together. I knew the ending of the Chalk Man, so I knew certain points I had to hit and certain plot points that were going to be in there.
Who'd have guessed they were triplets after all?
spoilers.
I very much enjoyed the 80s references, being in my 40s in Chalk Man.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
References to bomb bags and things.
Teenage years.
There were some fantastic ideas in the 80s, weren't there?
I love the 80s. I've got a huge fondness for... Well, I think at the decade that you're a teenager in, you've always got a real fondness for, haven't you? So like 86, when the Chalk Man was set, I would have been 14.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was 13, 14. So, yeah, it was you know, definitely sort of my time. It feels like a really vivid time to me. And I think things, when you're a teenager, things are more vivid.
Yeah,
particularly in the 80s. The 80s were very vivid.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just colour scheme-wise, let alone anything else.
But, yeah, so much of that's come around again, though, hasn't it?
The socks, the neon socks.
Odd neon socks, if you called it.
Bra skirts, leg warmers. Love it. Yeah, I love the fact that stuff's back.
What were those things that you put on your head called?
Hats.
Deedy boppers.
Deedy
boppers. That was a great fad, that wasn't it? That needs to come back.
Deedy boppers. They were brilliant. Yeah, the 80s were great, you know. And I think, well, at the time, probably by the time you got to the 90s, you thought they were naff, but now we're far enough away to go, no, they were really good.
They were. I remember once we went on holiday to North Wales, and in a shop there by the seaside, I managed to buy some Aha sweatbands.
Oh, very cool.
So that's like the dream.
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
Big in Wales.
Yeah.
Have you got a good memory? Did you ever keep a diary or anything? Because you seem to just remember the 80s better than I do.
No, I didn't. But I'm in touch with all my friends that, you know, I was friends with in the 80s at that age. We were still in touch. And we, you know, when I was in Nottingham, we used to get together quite regularly and go for drinks and stuff. So I think a lot of it was reminiscing of, do you remember when this happened? And do you remember when that happened? And we did this and that happened and so and so.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think we sort of kept it very much alive because of that, really. But yeah, I was going to say, I was showing my little girl a picture of myself. Because my mum's got more of them than me, I'm sure. But I found one of me in a lovely, it's a turquoise blue jumpsuit. The white jacket.
Nice.
And I think I was just growing out a bit of a perm with some sun in it.
I think the scary thing is we can all immediately see that.
Yeah.
Knowing the
you know where I am.
Yeah. Oh, that's a lot of fabric.
And she was horrified. She's absolutely horrified by it. It was like, for a start, it's like, Mummy, you have hair. Because obviously now it's keep it really short.
The Failing Writers Podcast. Recommended by 8 out of 10 dentists and 9 out of 10 cats. And therefore by literally all of the feline orthodontists we've ever met. I mean, that's just maths, isn't it?
So I was thinking that, like, the flip side of getting that magical sort of Stephen King tweet is when you do something and it becomes a bestseller, as you've had a few of now, That must bring some sort of negative publicity as well. Do you have the sort of trolls that come after you in any way, or have you had to deal with any sort of bad reviews?
Oh God, yeah. Normally, I mean, there's a site called Goodreads that most authors know after a while. It's not a good place to visit, really. But when you're a debut, when you're first writing a book, you want to know what people think of it, obviously. Generally on things like Twitter, people only sort of tag you in and contact you with the nice stuff. You get a few people who tag you in with bad reviews, but everyone knows that's kind of not the done thing. But, you know, if you seek out reviews, then unfortunately you're going to get burnt at some stage. And with the Chalk Man, you know, the first few reviews were lovely. It was great. I was like, this is amazing. And then inevitably you get your first one-star review. And you're like, what? What the hell? Who's given me this review? And then as the more reviews you get, obviously the more bad reviews you get. And obviously the more popular a book seems to be and the more hyped I think a book is, particularly you get those people who really do want to bring it down. You know, oh, well, you know, everyone else liked this, but I thought it was rubbish.
Successful.
That sort of thing as well.
Yeah.
But I got some really hateful ones for the Chalk Man, because a lot of people, I don't think, got the sort of fact that it was, I say it was my homage to Stephen King and all that sort of stuff that I loved, and really just thought I was just trying to rip off Stephen King, which was not the intention at all. It kind of, the purpose of it kind of went straight over their heads, really.
Which I was going to say before, that tweet from Stephen King could have gone two ways, couldn't it? Depending on his perspective on that.
I think it was supposed to be a real wink, because he got all the references. So I think it was really like, if you like my stuff, you'll like this, because he got it.
But it could have been a very different...
Yeah, he could have been suing me. You'll hear from my brother, Tudor.
You're like the UK female Stephen King, and we will discuss this further in a court of law.
But yeah, some of his hardcore fans really didn't like it. They didn't like this British female at the start, you know, trampling his territory. So I got some real bastard reviews. Yeah, really, really nasty ones. But that's how you learn, isn't it? You know, then, you know, you learn not to seek out those bad reviews then. So for the other books, I don't go looking for bad reviews. I might just skim the first few nice reviews on Goodreads, but I don't seek out the 1 or 2 star ones, because, you know, they can be really unpleasant. Funny enough, sometimes the 3-star ones can be the worst, though, because they're nearly always the ones that catch you at that bit that you doubt yourself. So if there's anything you're not sure of about a book, you can guarantee the 3-star reviews will probably mention it.
This book had a really strong start. Oh, good, good. But then in the middle... middle bit.
Exactly. No, don't mention
not that twist.
around page 200.
Yeah, right.
It felt like the writer had got to the top of a hump, but not managed to get over it quite.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can, the funniest ones are the ones you can tell are from what I call... And I don't mean it in a mean way, because, you know, we've all been there, sort of frustrated writers. We've all been that frustrated writer who's read a book that perhaps disappoints us. And, you know, books are subjective, you know? I'm not going to say, you know, everyone should love
my
book.
You have to ask yourself, though, Kaz, what kind of person would leave that kind of review?
Terrible human beings, mostly, wouldn't they?
Terrible human beings.
Yeah. Do you ever get somewhere it's quite clear that they haven't read the book? So they're sort of, you know, like, Chalk Man. Well, I got hit by a chalk duster when I was at school. 1 star. I don't like this.
Some of you do get where they're just like... The funny thing is, you do get repeat reviewers who obviously don't like your books.
But keep
reviewing them. So it'll be like, I hated The Chalk Man, but I thought I'd give this one another. Or I hated the author's other books. And this one, I still don't like them. It's like, wait, why? Are you some kind of masochist? For God's sake, go and read something else. Why are you doing this to yourself? Or this isn't my genre. Well, so why? Why are you reading it?
Why are you doing it? The first four
all
times.
All 37 of your books have been terrible. I am not looking forward to the next one coming
I'm
out.
I'm dreading the next one.
I've set aside a week to read the next one. I'm not looking forward to it.
Guaranteed sales then.
But people are just really strange. I don't get that. It's like, if you didn't like the first one, for God's sake, don't read the rest of them.
Yeah, this is not for you.
How many books altogether, Kaz?
So four. Crikey. Four books. I am... Well, I say I've finished the fifth, but... I think this is the interesting thing, actually. The fifth book I've finished may not be a book that comes out next year, and actually it may be something else that I'm working on that we actually do skip and put something out in 2023 instead for various reasons. But I'm actually having an editorial meeting about that tomorrow, so I don't know quite which way it's going to go yet. There may be a book next January, but there may be a novella next summer, and the kind of passion project I'm working on may come out in 2023, because that needs a little bit longer. But we'll see. It's a little bit up in the air at the moment. But yeah, four published books and more to come. Many more to come, hopefully.
Excellent.
I have the Burning Girls in my hands as we speak. And I've got a copy signed by the author, which always makes you think two things. The first one, I've got a terrible signature.
So is mine.
If I ever actually finished a book. Well, no, yours, I mean, yours looks like a proper signature. Mine looks like a child's just scribbled over something. And I often worry, if I finished a book and someone asked for a signed copy, they'd get it and go, what's this? I'm not having this. It's just rubbish.
But yeah, on the other hand, you could get other people to sign them. They wouldn't know. Just scribble.
That's true. Yeah. I could just get a signed copy. I didn't say who it was signed by. Just signed. But what's that like to do? Is that a bit of a pain in the ass? Do you have to sort of set aside a day and sit down and sign things? Or have you done, obviously not recently, but book signings in bookstores?
No, thank God. And everyone would hate those. Because, you know, basically, you know, unless you're Stephen King, you know, you're not going to get many people turn up. Because people don't like actually approaching someone who sat in a bookstore.
You know who turns up to those, don't you? People who give 3-star reviews.
Exactly. I read your book. Didn't like it.
Could you sign the book?
Could you sign this book? I hate it. But yeah, oh God, no one does those.
I've had to travel 50 miles to come and see you today. The train journey was awful.
I hated your book. I do have a friend who that almost pretty much happened to. She was at like some event or something, and someone came up to her just to tell her how much she hated the ending of her book. It's like, oh,
so what do you say? Thank you. Thank you very much.
All you can say is, oh, thanks. Thank you. Thanks for letting me know. Signing books is weird. The first time you do it, you feel like an imposter. It's a very odd thing. At events and stuff like that. And then sort of, you know, if you, you know, you're lucky, it is nice. Waterstones, you know, send you books to sign and things. And I had one of my books, The Other People, was in Target. It was chosen with the Target Books of the Month or whatever they do in the US. And I had to sign 7,000 copies of it.
Whoa.
Bloody hell.
So that did take a few days.
And have you thought about trying to train the dogs that you walk to be able to hold a pen? Because if you could, say
then,
if you were walking like...
Betty to do it now.
Yeah.
If you earn her pocket money, you know, her writing's pretty good.
Yeah.
Because I don't like, it doesn't matter who you are. If you sign 7,000 books, the signature in the 7,000th is not going to look the same as
it's
going to
be a
one,
slightly bumpy line,
very
isn't
true.
It? That's it.
Very true. Yeah.
It's just going to be an X.
Yeah, you really want one of the first 10 books, don't you?
Yeah.
One of the good ones, but it's just like, oh, God.
Yeah, for God's sake. Yeah.
That's when you really make it, Kaz. You'll get a stamp that looks like a...
I know some authors do have stamps. Yes, successful authors do have to stamp it. Yeah, that's when you know you've really made it. It's true.
so as you go through all these amazing books, Kaz, obviously it must be like similar for sort of musicians as well. Like your first book, you can kind of take as long as you want on to get it, you know, exactly as you want it before it gets submitted. But once you kind of get a deal, you end up with a schedule, I suppose. So how do you find that when suddenly you've got like, okay, the next book is coming out on this date in this year, so you've got to finish it by then. Can you sort of describe that change in the process?
Yeah, it is difficult. I think a lot of authors find this, because you're right, the first book you have, you know, all the time in the world basically to write and ready and submit. And then suddenly you are on this, you know, this schedule basically. And what I found is it gets squeezed tighter and tighter, because, you know, the second book, fortunately, I had quite a lot of it written before The Chalk Man was published. So that wasn't too bad. But then inevitably, you know, I didn't start the third book till probably, say the second book was published in January. I didn't finish the next book. I finished the next book, say, till March that year, and it's out the next year. Well, what you tend to find is instead of having, say, a year or 2 years to write a book, you have 11 months. Then 10 months, then maybe 8 months to get this book submitted, because you've got all the other stuff that goes in. If you're slightly late delivering, then you have the promotion stuff and you have events. And then, you know, before the lockdowns, I was traveling quite a lot because I was published in quite a few countries. And then you're promoting the paperback. And so your time gets eaten into. So you find you have less and less really to actually sit down and write. And I think that's kind of culminated a bit for me in book five, because I was trying to write that during lockdown. And then there was a lot of stuff going on with my parents, and I lost my dad in January. And so it was a really difficult book to write. It was interrupted a lot. It was writing it at a really difficult time. Then I was later submitting it. So you suddenly go, oh, crumbs. You know, I've got a very short amount of time to write the next book, which is going to be quite, you know, a big book. It's a slight change. It's quite high concept. And I sort of need that extra time. Hence, perhaps we might not be, you know, we might be spending some more time on that. So your schedule does get squeezed. And I think a lot of authors find that. And a lot of authors do have to perhaps take a year between books sometimes. to sort of catch back up. And it feels like you're being really lazy or greedy or something, because, you know, readers are very lovely and they're like, oh, I can't wait for your book next year. And it seems like a long time when you're waiting to read a book. When you're trying to write a book, yeah. It's actually no time at all. Yeah, yeah. So it feels very sort of, you know, a little bit selfish to sort of want to take an extra year. But sometimes you just have to, because the worse than not delivering a book is delivering a book that everyone's disappointed with, you know? It's like, oh, yeah, well, it's not yeah. as good as
well,
other
yeah.
books. You don't want that, because you want people to enjoy each book more, hopefully. Yeah.
So does most of the deadline pressure come from you, Kaz, or does it come from the
it's
publisher?
It's a little bit both ways, I guess, isn't it? I like to deliver my books in good time, because I know that if you're late delivering a book, yeah. as I've just said, then you're late starting the next one, and it all starts getting more and more compressed. And you know, you don't want that pressure on yourself. But yeah, there is a point where, you know, the publishers will be saying, okay, you kind of need it now. kind of got to have that book. I have a friend who's an author, and well, for both of his books, he's been very late delivering the books. But he's a brilliant author, and they kind of sort of let him get away with it. But yeah, I don't think he's ever hit a deadline in his life. but then, you know, publishers are relatively tolerant if your books are doing well. They get less tolerant if your books aren't doing well, obviously.
Yeah, imagine. So it's,
all checks and balances, really. But yeah, personally, I don't like letting people down. I like to deliver books on time. I sort of, you know, don't like being late and missing deadlines and things.
Thanks for listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. Thanks for subscribing. But mostly, thanks for just being you. You're great, you are.
I am aware that one of your books, I'm not entirely sure which one now, but one of your books has been optioned as a TV show, is that right?
Yeah, about all four of them have been optioned for TV. I just haven't been able to announce two of them. But options are weird things, because they basically mean we like your book and we'd like to do something with it. Now we have to go away and get some money to do something and see if people will let us make it. And like from basically being optioned to hopefully anything happening can often be 3 years easily.
Right.
Because TV and stuff is very, very slow. So yeah, they have all been optioned. The Chalkman has been optioned by BBC Studios in conjunction with an American production company. And The Burning Girls has been optioned by a production company. And they both have scriptwriters attached, actually. We have Hans Rosenfeld attached for The Burning Girls, who is amazing because he was responsible for The Bridge and Marcella. So he's a brilliant scriptwriter.
Oh, right, okay.
So I'm very excited about that. So they're sort of a little bit further on. The other two have been optioned, but are just really at that option, getting backing, pitching to, you know, other production companies and you know, that sort of stage. So it's a long process. The nice thing is they pay you an option fee, and that's normally for about a year or 18 months. Then if they don't do anything with it, but they still want to do something with it, they pay you again. So, you know, it's,
bloody hell.
It's all extra money.
That sounds like the dream, doesn't it?
Don't have to do anything for it. Brilliant.
Just keep getting optioned every year. So did that feel like another sort of big here I am moment, or is it always been more about the books?
It's
for
a strange thing, because, you know, I always wanted to just write books. I didn't want to write TV, you know. I wanted to write books and see my books on bookshelves. But it seems like every time you write a book now, or any author, the next question is it going to be, adapted for TV? Because books are suddenly, so many books are being adapted for TV or film.
Yeah.
And that seems, you feel a little bit like, if you say no, you feel a bit like, you know, you're unsuccessful. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was never, I call it the icing on the cake. It's lovely. It's a lovely, you know, it's a lovely sort of vote of confidence. But again, options, I've learned not to get carried away with it, because quite frankly, most of the books optioned won't ever, ever make it to screen. You know, they get optioned. Yeah. It's not a huge amount of money as far as the TV companies are concerned. They don't have to pay out too much for it. And if they do something, they do. And a lot of the time they won't make it to screen. So you've got to sort of be healthily cynical about it and not get carried away and go, it would be lovely if something happens. But, you know, until they sort of tell me it's been green lit and it's actually happening, you know, I won't believe it. But, you know, it's thank you for the option fee. It's nice to be asked. So,
yeah, better than not having it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So what else then does the future hold? Kaz, you talked about maybe changing the schedule for the next couple of books, but further on than that, do you see anything outside of like the horror genre, or anything that you've got a burning desire to do?
Well, I mean, I'm never going to sit down and write a romance. I think that's pretty much a given. That's really not my kind of thing. But it's interesting that the whole thing with books 5 and 6 actually was because all my books so far have been kind of, I think they've trodden the line between thrillers and mysteries with a little bit of sort of supernatural kind of horror. But it's sort of, you know, a bit of sort of a balance in them. And I think you always want to do different things because you don't want to get stale. You don't want to feel like you're doing it by numbers. And you want to kind of challenge yourself. And I had this really exciting idea for the book that was going to be book six, might be book five. And I think I pitched it to my agent as basically a triple locked room mystery / post-apocalyptic horror thriller.
Not another one of them.
Another one of those. And she didn't go, oh, God, not another one of those books. She didn't balk too much, and nor did my publishers when I kind of pitched them the idea as well. Because it is a little bit more high concept. It's quite a bit different from the books I have published so far. But I was just really excited about it, and I had a really good idea for it. And they're basically letting me write, giving me enough rope to hang myself, basically.
Well, you've earned it now, haven't you?
But I think you've got to keep wanting to do different stuff. I mean, I've always said that's why I couldn't write a series where it's just the same character. You know, you follow the same character throughout the books, because I'd find that really mind-numbingly boring. I like having different books and a different playground, and I'm always looking for different things that I can do. So I'm really, really excited about that one. It's called Drift. I'm really excited. I'm having a lot of fun writing it as well. And that's what it's got to be, hasn't it? You've got to keep having fun writing stuff. I mean, I'm lucky I've got a contract for the next three books with Penguin, and I've got a contract for the next two books with Penguin Ballantine in the US. And I'm also very fortunate that, you know, I've got quite a few foreign publishers who keep coming on board for the next books. So, you know, that's a really lovely, lucky, privileged position to be in. And, you know, hopefully that will continue, because I just want to keep writing. So, you know, you want to keep writing, writing books people enjoy, and, you know, keep publishers happy, keep readers happy. And that's what it's all about, really, isn't it? Just keep being able to do this.
Yeah, that's what kind of we're all about, isn't it? Trying to get to the point of just doing stuff for the sake of enjoying it. And if something else happens, great.
A lot of authors, you know, I was very lucky because The Chalk Man was a big book and it sold in, you know, loads and loads of territories and everything. And that gave me a great head start. So I'm able to write full time. You know, not every author is, you know, every published author is able to do that even, you know, because it is a tricky industry. It's that old, you know, you're only as good as the last book type of thing. So there is pressure, like with everything, there's pressure to get the sales, to sort of hit that top 10 if you can. So, you know, you are aware of that, but ultimately when you're writing, you kind of have to put that stuff out of your head. And like I say, don't think about writing to be published or what will readers think or what will the publishers think. You've just got to write stuff that you're passionate about. And I think that then comes through in the book.
I think that's a fantastic place to end it on, actually.
Yeah, it's quite an uplifting. Yeah, actually, that's an uplifting ending, isn't it? So maybe
I can end it on a downbeat note as well if you want, you know. It's totally up to you.
We could do a choose your own ending.
Choose your own ending.
they're 80s books, aren't they?
Basically, it's incredibly tough to get published. And one publisher said to me, and there are loads of writers out there who are brilliant who are not published, because it's not just about being a great writer. Books are turned down for all sorts of reasons, not because they're not great books. One publisher said to me it was his job to every day turn down brilliant books and brilliant authors just because they didn't fit with what they were publishing that year. It was too similar to another author. It wasn't what people were looking to read at that particular time. It is really difficult. I feel very lucky that, you know, I get to write and publish books. But, you know, it's not, as I always say to people, it's like just because you've got rejected with that book this year, next year, that might be the book that every publisher wants. So you've just got to sort of hang on to that. It's a lot of, well, there is a degree of talent. I think a lot of it is luck and timing as well.
That's a bit more downbeat, isn't it? I think I prefer the upbeat version.
I like the downbeat one, if I'm honest. A bit more satisfying, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that was really great, Kaz. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks, Kaz. Thank you so much indeed. And best of luck with all the other books.
Yay!
Cheers, Kaz.
Bye.
See ya, bye. See ya. Wow, exclamation mark. That was good, wasn't
Excellent.
It?
Excellent. And thanks for coming on, Kaz.
Very interesting. And what a career she's had just in the last few years.
Bit annoying. Makes you jealous. In many ways.
I know, yeah.
She is one of the best dog walkers in the country. I mean, that's very, very good. Very good dog walker.
We could break into that market.
Yeah.
Not the dog walking market. The horror, the horror market. Do you think we could? Because it's a big area. We could get a slice of that action.
It doesn't appeal to my writing chops at all. That
doesn't it?
You could say it fills me with horror. It just
really?
Doesn't. Yeah, it's not my genre. I don't really watch horror stuff. It just doesn't.
Well, you know what we should do then?
Yeah, test you.
We should set you a task, Tommy. We should set all of us a task. Yeah. To write some, just to prove that that's not true.
Well,
but you've got a page, a single page, about 500 words, to scare
right,
us.
Right, okay. That sounds less daunting.
Each other.
Yeah.
Like a scary page of writing.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
A scary page. A very short story.
So that could be like three or four words and lots of exclamation marks.
Could be. Just be, 500 words, horror story. Scare the crap out of us.
That's going to be very hard for me.
That's going to be quite hard, isn't it?
It's
about interesting. I think it could be very interesting.
Well, the good thing is we've got two weeks to do it, because next week's episode, we've got another interview coming up.
Oh, yes. Very good interview with Kate Fox.
Yeah.
The lovely Kate Fox.
Stand-up poet.
It's a total change of pace, but that's a very interesting interview as well. And some exclusive readings of her poems too. So
she's so lovely and honest, isn't she? And funny.
Things sadly missing from this podcast.
Yes, like
most of the time. So let's look forward to that. So that's next week. So we've got 2 weeks, chaps, to do your horror fiction, 500 words, scary stuff.
We can do that.
Let's do it. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?